Stephen Gates is a self-proclaimed Epicurean desperado, living for wild culinary quests, weird food, and hardcore feasting. Gates covers food for the BBC and is the author of the book titled Gastronaut. To Gates, a gastronaut is someone who will stop at nothing to experience the transcendent moment through food, no matter how bizarre. He says staging your own emu is one way to go.
It's where you take a whole, either a pig or a whole sheep or a whole deer, and you dig a vast pit in your garden, or, well, preferably somebody else's garden, and you have to create a huge fire in the bottom of this pit, and you need to take out about a ton and a half or 2 tons of earth, so a big, big pit. You create a huge fire, and then you, on top of that fire, you have to put about a metric ton of iron, which you can pick up from your local scrapyard. And you feed this fire for about 3 hours until the iron is absolutely red hot. Meanwhile, you wrap up your whole animal in lots and lots of bed sheets, and then wrap all of that in foil around the top, and then another bed sheet around that again.
You're making this up, aren't you?
I'm not making it up, I swear. I've done this one. And in fact, it's quite a big thing in New Zealand and Australia. They'll call it a hangi out there.
Okay, you've got it wrapped in yards of bed sheets and covered with foil, and then...
That's right. And then you lower it down onto the red-hot iron, and you use iron because it's the one thing that will retain heat for hours and hours and hours. In New Zealand, they'll use volcanic rocks, but in North London, they're quite hard to come by. So you lower your pig down to that, and then you get all of the soil that you dug out, and you throw it back on. So you basically bury this pig all over again. Now, I've found that all of the processes of getting the iron, digging the pit, negotiating with your mates to let them dig up their garden, this tends to take about 7 days, and getting all of the stuff together and ordering your pig, it's a huge operation. And then once you've lowered your pig into the pit and covered it up, that's another 8 hours. You leave it there to cook for about 8 hours, and it basically sort of steams and braises in this pit. The point is, it might take a long time, but it will feed, it'll often, you know, a large pig can feed 60 people.
Well, this is clearly a recipe that is not going to be pursued by just anyone at any time. There are others that seem a little bit more accessible, although I'm not sure how appealing they are. For instance, you have one recipe in which you cook with gold, which sounds luxurious, but I don't know how good for you it is.
Well, gold, in actual fact, gold is entirely inert. It has absolutely no nutritional value whatsoever. There's a great saying from some of the earlier nutritionalists, like Pliny the Elder, and that is that every single substance on earth is bad for you. You can die from water. You can die from eating too much bread. There is a poison, a toxin level for every single substance. Now, eating a little bit of gold is absolutely fine. I've done quite a bit of research in this with doctors in the UK. It basically gives you nothing except golden teeth and a slight feeling of fear. And most of my friends, when I make golden sausages, most of my friends tend to say, is this going to clash with my fillings? Is it going to make my teeth, set my teeth on edge? And also, are they going to have golden poo at the end of it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, sadly. Maybe you're laying a golden egg, but certainly not golden poo.
I see.
And also, you'll tend to get little bits in your mouth. But doing these things, especially with the gold, I mean, that's an interesting one, because it doesn't make the food taste any different at all. It's purely psychological. But when you do these things, it takes a meal with your friends and makes it ever so slightly transcendental. You're not quite sure what's going on, but there's just a magical sense in the air and fear.
Now, you talk about cooking with gold. Is this something that anybody can do? I mean, can you help me through the process of doing this?
It's gloriously easy. It's so easy to do. You need to find some gold. Now, that's the first stage. Generally, you'll find this very easily from art shops. A lot of people use it for gilding frames, or they'll use it in paintings. You need to get pure gold. Now, pure gold is 24 karat gold. If it's anything less than 24 carats, it tends to be cut with copper and nickel, so always best to go for the pure stuff. And it's sort of bizarrely cheap. You buy a book of gold, and you get about 25 leaves, and I think it's less than $30.
Which, so do you just take a leaf and wrap it around your Cheeto and go from there?
Exactly. I'd say sausages are an easier thing to start with. Cheetos are slightly more complicated. But what's great about a sausage is it's got a little... You have to cook them first. Sausages cook first and then let them cool for a little while. And what's great is they've got a very thin layer of fat around them. And so the gold will stick very easily to the fat. You wipe off most of the fat, but make sure it's just a little bit sticky. And then because you get this transfer leaf, you literally just roll the sausage across the leaf and it takes the gold and the gold will stick to the sausage. It's really, really easy. Mm. And I swear, your friends will come round, have supper with you, and remember that golden sausage for the rest of their lives.
How long do you look at it before you put your fork in it?
Well, basically, you have to go through all of their questions first. They'll have all of their neuroses, and they'll be very surprised, and then they'll be slightly mesmerized by it. And the first person will have a little bite, and everybody will be watching and waiting to hear them say, "Oh my God, that tastes really strange." And then everybody will start digging in. It takes a little while, but and it's absolutely fine. I wouldn't eat them every night of the week because there have been no tests done on chronic ingestion of gold. But every now and then, once a year, you can have a golden sausage, I'd say, at least once a year.
And I must say that it sounds more appealing to me, although there is that element of fear in there, than the suggestion that you cook with a variety of aftershaves.
Yes. The aftershave one is interesting because it's one of the few recipes in the book that absolutely doesn't work. And the book's very, very clear about this, that it seemed like a brilliant idea at the time. I was in the house thinking, I've got some friends coming around. I'd really like to do something strange, something that will make them stop in their tracks. And I was looking at my wife's perfume and moisturizers and stuff, and whether or not I could moisturize a leg of lamb. And then I thought, no, that's not going to work. And then I saw my aftershave, and I liked the flavor of it. And I thought, well,
you liked the flavor of it?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of makes me smell vaguely presentable in the morning, so it can't be such a bad thing. And also, it's a combination of spices and herbs with alcohol, which no bad thing, really, for me. And so I thought, well surely this must be good news. And I thought, there can't be anything wrong with it. I'm only going to use a little bit of it. Of course, there's a lot wrong with it, because I went to the website of the people that make Old Spice, and they said chronic ingestion is likely to cause mass nausea, all sorts of different medical problems. But of course, you know, I wasn't planning on drinking a lot of it. I just needed a little drizzle. So I went ahead, and in actual fact, I made a ceviche, which I thought would be best. Then you don't really cook anything, so I'd keep all the flavours. And I tasted it, and I thought, this is absolutely fantastic. And for the first sort of 20 seconds, I was thinking, this is genius. I'm going to conquer the world in ready meals with a little pack of aftershave with them. And then after about 20 seconds, you get this blinding sourness that surges up from the back of your throat and basically envelops your head. And basically, there are lots of ethanols and strange alcoholic residues left in the uh-huh. in the aftershave, meaning that it's really bloody horrible.
Now, you talked about Pliny the Elder, which suggests that you have done a fair amount of research into the history of food. In fact, I know that you have written about some of the most magnificent feasts of all time, and I wondered if you'd tell us about some of those.
Well, I guess the classic feast is Trimalchio's feast. It was a hedonistic extravaganza, which I think can be safely described as an orgy, although there wasn't a lot of sex involved. And it's as much a piece of theatre as a culinary experiment. But it was lots of pigs with sausages spilling out of them and opening up a cake and live things crawling out. And in certainly Roman times, there was a good gastronautical strain where people liked to shock other people and they like bringing strange foods back. And I think this is beginning to happen now. People are enjoying exploring with food a lot more. The only trouble with Trimalchio's feast is it was actually all made up. It's a story as part of a longer book, but it has gone down in history as one of the great suppers of all time. Mm. Obviously, there's the Last Supper, which must be the most famous meal of all time, although the food is rarely mentioned. It was your basic Passover meal. Mm. There are interesting things about that. When you look at pictures, there's a picture of the Last Supper, I think is it in Mexico? I can't remember off the top of my head. But in the Last Supper there, what's in front of Jesus and the disciples is actually a guinea pig, a roasted guinea pig, which goes to show that
it does seem unlikely,
around
doesn't
the world. Exactly, but it's much more part of the culture.
Now, for those of us who are really tired of dull dinner parties, you know, serving the same thing each week, you suggest staging your own Bacchanalian orgy, and I wonder, I have no experience of this, I confess, and I wondered if you could kind of lead me through. What do you need for a good Bacchanalian orgy?
Well, the whole thing about an orgy is I obviously can't guide you on the sort of sex element of it, but it's all about theatre, really. The modern Bacchanalian orgy is a combination of intellectual sort of discourse and insane food. So you can make violet wine. If you can catch any dormice around your house, they're great, sprinkled with honey and poppy seeds. Small birds, quails would do, but in times of your little fig peckers would have been the thing.
You know, I'm beginning to see why there isn't much sex involved in this.
Well, a lot of food and everybody would be feeling slightly queasy. Is that what you're thinking?
It did cross my mind, yes.
There is actually, bizarrely, there is a cookbook that comes down from Roman times. It's called The Roman Cookery of Apicius, who was, well, it's a little bit hazy as to exactly who he was, but there's certainly a cookbook ascribed to him. And in there are hundreds of recipes. It's absolutely fascinating because it's a snapshot of how people ate in Roman times, a proper snapshot. I'd say it's probably our earliest proper cookery book. There are recipes that have been found much earlier than that, but it's our earliest proper cookbook. The other things that you can do are just doing things that are surprising. Mock turtle soup, rhinoceros soup, you can buy deep-fried insects on the internet. There are lots of sites in Thailand that will send you these things. Small animals tend to be very popular. If you can get your hands on a suckling pig, that tends to help. And then you need to sort of stage it. I'd recommend getting cushions out on the floor, kicking all of your sofas out of the room and putting down a big rug with all of the food on the floor and lots of cushions for people to hang out on. And then get your friends to read some poetry. If you've got any friends that any good on the guitar, get them to try. And obviously everyone should wear a toga.
Stephen Gates is an Epicurean desperado who covers food for the BBC, and he's the author of the book Gastronaut.